Thanks a lot. I will have the same apology as Jennifer, but in the opposite direction, because I didn't expect there to be such a great introduction to the theory before showing the observations. But just to summarize the bottom line in terms of the observers, or at least what we were aware of when this whole thing started, there's the big issue of the opacities, and Jennifer showed us how great they are at calculating them, but there's still an uncertainty about what the content of the ejecta is, and so what the composition is would drive the opacities. And so there was still a lot of uncertainty there, and as Jennifer mentioned, basically we didn't know if to expect a fast blue event or a long red event or both, which is what ended up happening. So the larger opacities make it fainter and longer and also shift the spectrum to the red. So we were uncertain, and here's a plot from Brian Metzger's review of like the kind of random walk in phase space that, well, maybe not random, the walk in phase space that theory has gone through, starting from the original predictions and then actually figuring out, okay, if it's the R process, it's going to be much fainter. And if we have these lanthanide opacities, it's going to be much redder and longer, but actually we could also have lanthanide-free ejecta, which would be bluer and shorter, and there are other emission components, very short timescales from the free neutrons, and so on and so forth. So there was not clear what to expect. And I should say even beyond, here's another set of models of increasing the opacity, really suppresses the optical bands. And this, we were quite worried about this, because the predictions were at 200 megaparsec, this is 24th magnitude, if we would be really unlucky with the opacities. But there were predictions that went even further and said, for a similar distance, this could actually be 10 magnitudes fainter in the optical. So that's quite a range for us to not know what to expect. This is 10 magnitudes, it's a factor of 10,000 in flux, and what to expect in the optical. Okay, so as an observer gearing up to try and find this thing, it was quite uncertain what we had to do. So we really didn't know for sure what to expect. Well, I'm sure some people knew exactly what would happen, but most of us did not know what to expect. So I figure since this is the first observational talk, I'll tell you a little bit about the discovery. Really quickly, there are two main methods to search for a kilonova given a gravitational wave localization. These are just examples. So the first one is take your wide field telescope and tile the entire region. This is great because you cover the entire region, but you also will find a lot of things. So if you search in the sky a large enough region, you will find a lot of things. And the other option for those of us without wide field telescopes is to focus on the galaxies inside the region. And it was shown by work by Neil Gehrels that this is a very actually practical and doable approach because 50% of the mass in a typical LIGO region will be contained in about 30 galaxies. So you don't get 100% of where the kilonova could be, but you only have to do about 30 pointings and you'll cover 50%. And we also know where most of these large galaxies are to those distances. So that is the other approach that was taken in this case. One complication, though, is we've seen these plots of the wonderful detection, but that is not exactly how it happened. This was what originally had happened. So there was a glitch in Livingston, and that turned out to be very important because it delayed the localization by 5 hours. And in the data I'll show you in a minute, that turned out to be quite critical, this delay. So the first thing, of course, and the other thing was the Fermi detection. So this was kind of different than the scenario we had imagined and that we would get a LIGO localization and start going. The Fermi localization came first, and it was quite large. And the LIGO localization, as I said, was delayed by 5 hours and was a little bit offset. So not only was the Fermi localization large, some of us who started looking, searching in the center of this localization, it turns out we were looking in the wrong place. We had to look here. So the bottom line is that there was this 5 hour delay before we could actually find the kilonova. And it was discovered by the SWOPE team, led by Ryan and Santa Cruz, were the first to observe it. And five more of us observed it within a span of 42 minutes, independent of each other. This is a reference image here where you clearly see there's nothing there and there's the kilonova. And this is different methods. So what I want to emphasize is that these six groups found the thing independently using different methods, even among the ones that search through galaxies. We're using different catalogs with different priorities and different criteria. And we all found ourselves observing the same thing within 40 minutes of each other. So I think that, you know, is a good prospect for the finding more of them in the future, that this is maybe not as hard as we expected, assuming this is a, you know, a typical kilonova and doesn't turn out to be the one that never happened again, and that's it. So very different methods. The other thing I want to emphasize in this picture is you will notice the kilonova is on top of a galaxy. So this makes the photometry a little bit uncertain. And it's not in the center of the galaxy, which is good, but there's still some gradient of light underneath the event that is hard to subtract in real time. So different groups have done different things in order to figure out, you know, separate the contribution from the kilonova from the contribution of the host galaxy. Some involve image subtraction, where you take an image without the kilonova and subtract it, but the problem here was that this event was only visible for 2 weeks before going into sun constraints. So did it fade fast enough in 2 weeks for us to be able to use that data to subtract? You know, we'll know when it comes back. The field is actually being visible now, again, starting now. So in the next few weeks, we should be able to get true reference images, where now we know the thing is gone, at least in the optical and infrared. Well, we'll see. And then, so just a word of warning to the theorists modeling this data. Even the published data, I would say, might not be the final word because of this issue of host galaxy contamination. So I recommend everyone wait, and I'm sure many of the groups are planning, as we are, to get the proper reference images now and do the subtraction and see if anything has changed. I doubt this will change much, especially around peak, but as the thing got fainter towards the end of the observability window, definitely things can move around a little bit, so please keep that in mind. So this was probably the most observed transient in history, 70 observatories, I think, in every continent. So every continent, pretty much probably every observatory on the planet, plus a few that are not on the planet. And so it's quite a hard thing to summarize. I'm going to focus on the optical in this talk. This is what was assigned to me. So the optical timescales are about a few hours from merger is when the Ryan's discovery happened, and for about a week or 10 days until it faded in the optical. You can see the infrared lasted longer, and Maria will talk about that after me. And you can see here all of the different notices these lines represent, GCN notices that were sent around. So in order to compile all of this, I want to mention two resources that I've used, which have been very helpful. So one of them is kilonova.space, which is James Gillotron's at Harvard collection of everyone's data in an online uniform format. Very useful to get. So I recommend if people are looking for data that they get it from there, and if you have data that you put it there so that we can all have it in one central place. And the other thing is Stefano Valenti, Maria Drought, and I compiled all of the papers that came out on the first day, so there's about 80 of them, onto this sortable, searchable list. You can search by your favorite group or your favorite wavelength range and find all the links to all the papers there, so please feel free to use that. It's at kilonov.org. If you're looking for Ido Berger's website, that's kilonova.org. So add the E if you're looking for this one. And it'll give you a list of the papers. And if your paper is not on there, there's some inaccuracy, please let me know. We really want to keep this up to date, but only the papers from the first day. If your paper came out on day two, I'm sorry. We draw the line somewhere. It's just that otherwise it'll be impossible. Okay, so what does all the optical data look like when put together? Here it is. Here is the optical light curve, or UV and optical, I should say. From the Swift bands in the UV all the way to the I band, Z and redward will be Maria's talk. And you can see several things already. So you can see that it declined very quickly in the bluer bands and slower as you go to the redder bands. And this continues even slower into the infrared, as I'm sure you'll see in Maria's talk. But even those infrared bands are still much faster than what we're used to. These would be the cobalt to iron or nickel to cobalt decay rates we see in supernova. That line is actually decaying. It's not horizontal, but I can't really see it on this time scale. Here's a comparison of just the W band here of the kilonova compared to the fastest supernovae we know, and also drops from type II Plateau supernovae, which are supposed to be fast, but clearly has defined a new realm of fast for transients this bright. So this was very clearly much more rapid. And I want to focus on the early time, so I'm going to switch to a log time scale, which makes it easier to see what's happening in the first hours here and the first day. So what I do want to emphasize is that what you saw, it may be more clear here, that there is a rise between the first and second points in the light curve, which I think you can see here as well in this W band, which is our data from Las Cumbres, but also when you combine other people's R-band data, you see this rise, and you see it maybe in the I-band as well, and you see a flat, pretty flat G-band. So there is maybe a peak that was found here, and this is important for constraining models. I should say the semi-transparent points are the actual data in the papers, and what I did is just averaged, just directly averaged the data from each epoch and each filter to make the opaque points. So yeah, clearly this is not, you know, the ultimate way to do this. The ultimate way to do this is get everyone's images and re-reduce it in a consistent way. As you can see, there are some inconsistent measurements that need to be taken care of, but as a rough first guess at the combined light curve, that's it. This is it. So in order to compare to models, I'm going to remove these lines. And so I'm going to compare to a few models. This is going to be a completely unfair comparison because I'm going to show you models that were made for certain subsets of the data. I don't, well, there was one paper out that tried to model the combined data set. The ones I'm going to show you now did not try to model the combined data set. They tried to model a subset, and I'll show you how they fare when compared to the combined data set. So we're going to start with Dan. Here are Dan's kilonova model for a very low lanthanide fraction, so ejecta mass and velocity, and this is lanthanide fraction very low, in order to really fit the fact that this was quite bright in the blue at early times. You can see it does a great job here in the redder bands, but as you go bluer, it's missing a lot of the blue emission already in G band, definitely in B, and the UV is definitely being missed here. So there's more blue emission than you would expect, even from this very low lanthanide fraction, which is what you need to get the opacities low enough to get the blue emission. So this is a one-component model. It was discussed whether there are multiple components, so you might need an even poorer, lower lanthanide fraction at early times to explain that. Here is Ashley Villar's paper about trying to do this with a combined data set. It's a little hard to see in this plot. They went from the UV to the infrared and tried to model all of that with a three-component kilonova model using Brian Metzger's model. So there's a red component, which is lanthanide-rich. There is a blue component, which is lanthanide-poor. And there's an intermediate, which I think they call purple component. And you can see that three components here for each band do a pretty good job of reproducing the data. But you know, this is a 10-parameter fit now. With these three components. So it's getting maybe a little bit complicated. The idea of these different components, I'm sure will be discussed a lot in the conference, is that there are different ejecta. So there is the equatorial. On the equatorial side, there's the dynamical ejecta from the tidal tails, which would be very lanthanide rich, so it would be very red, and if you were seeing it from this direction, you would only see the red component. Then there could be ejecta from the in the polar direction, which would be irradiated, as was mentioned earlier, by neutrinos, and would make the electron fraction higher, would make it lanthanide poor, so it would be bluer. And in addition, there could be accretion disks, which drive winds, that would be another ejecta component with different properties as well. And depending on the viewing angle, you might see different combinations of these components. And one of the interpretations was we were at a pretty lucky viewing angle where we saw several of them. And then this is also radio at later times, which I'm not going to go into in this talk. So there could be different components, and that could explain the blue part of the light curve. Or alternatively, or in addition, there could be a different mechanism for the blue emission, which would also explain the gamma ray emission, which is, again, something I'm not getting into in this talk, but I'm sure will be discussed later. Where a jet breaking out, whether successful or not, creates this cocoon of material that when that cools and breaks out of the ejecta, it can produce a blue component as well. So how do those models fare? So again, unfair comparison, because this this was the fair comparison to the bolometric light curve, and you see that this cocoon emission fits the temperature and bolometric luminosity very well. What happens if we compare this to the multiband light curve? So you can see it does pretty well in almost all the bands, and this is assuming this bolometric luminosity is distributed through a black body at that temperature, which I know is not what the model necessarily predicts. But if you just do that, you get a pretty good fit to all the bands. One critical point, or might be critical point, I don't know, is that this model specifically is declining on all of the different bands, whereas I think, you know, it's roughly consistent with where the points are, but it's not consistent with the idea of there being a rise here, and especially, you know, if you extrapolate this rise to earlier times, that would give you a bigger difference. So one thing about this model, at least the parameters in this specific model that was used to fit the bolometric light curve, is that it seems to be declining in most of the bands, which might not be what we're seeing in the observations. So what does the SED actually look like? This is actually quite a problematic issue. So you see the first, this is the discovery epoch at about 11 or 12 hours after merger. There are all of these bands, and then the UV happened a few hours later, about 4 or 5 hours later, if I'm not something like that mistaken, so from SWIFT. Now the question is, do you include this UV bands in the modeling of this epoch? If you do, the SED looks like this. So here's the UV bands from a few hours later compared to all the rest of this data. And so you see it doesn't fit a black body. This is the best fit black body that you can get at around 6,000 degrees. But if you assume that the UV was actually brighter at that epoch, which it probably was, but we don't really know by how much, because this is right around when this peak turnaround might be happening, you would get a higher temperature and a higher bolometric luminosity. If you ignore this U-band data completely, you can fit, you know, this would be a tail of a much hotter black body that would give you an even higher bolometric luminosity. So it's very hard to make this measurement of the bolometric luminosity, but if you do try to fit the data this way and get the lower estimate on the temperature, that's the bolometric luminosity and temperature you get. And you see, then you see this kind of flattening or rise also in the bolometric light curve. So what happens if I do the unfair comparison of now this bolometric light curve with the pre-existing model? So they fare pretty well. Here's Dan's kilonova. Here's Brian Metzger's kilonova, and I should say this is quite impressive considering this model was made 7 years before the object was discovered. Just a fiducial model in their 2010 paper actually fits it quite nicely. And here's the cocoon model, which I said mostly only declines. You don't see the rise. And the reason it's over there is because that's the bolometric point you get if you don't include the UV or include or extrapolate it to earlier times being brighter. So it actually turns out to be really critical. What was that UV flux at early times? Is the bolometric light curve up here or is it down here? In that, was it declining and consistent with the cocoon model, or was there a rise? In which case some, you know, would that be inconsistent with the cocoon model, or can you modify it or modify that component of it to make it rise at early times as well? So I'll just conclude by saying that to me, one of the interesting things about the UV optical light curve is what made the blue emission at early times. Can it be fully explained by low opacity kilonova ejecta or the cocoon model or both? What will we learn in either case? How can we distinguish? And I do want to emphasize the importance of early data, this ambiguity of that first data point, which is very important between discriminating between these models, would have maybe been solved if the localization actually would have come out even half an hour earlier, definitely an hour earlier. We would have, this was over South Africa, we could have observed it then, got another point. SWIFT maybe could have observed it earlier, we would have gotten the earlier UV. So, you know, I know there was a glitch, it was taken care of, that's great. I'm not blaming anyone. Just saying, please, LIGO people, keep in mind for the future to do this as quickly as, you know, you can. This early data is important, we want to get on it as soon as possible. And I think it's just one example of the kind of discriminatory, you know, discriminating between models we can do the earlier we get on it and the most bands we get on it. So thank you very much.
So Yair, I mean, you sort of said this, but I wanted to also point out in the slide where you show the bolometric light curve that we did the bolometric light curve calculation a couple of different ways. One is by interpolating between the data that you have and trying to fit a low-order polynomial and reconstructing the bolometric light curve that way. Or the other way is just using an MCMC fit to all the data to a particular temperature or luminosity function. And both of those give a perfect fit to the cocoon model, and we don't see any evidence for a rise. But as you
Right.
say, the data is very much, I mean, the fact that we are missing data in the first 10 hours is the crux of the problem
Right,
here.
right. So you need to
So,
know what was this doing backwards in time here?
right.
Was it rising or was it turning around like the other bands were? And I think there's just no
So
way
I
to know
think
that.
I would say it's an open question on
Yeah.
whether there was that early rise or
Yes,
not.
I agree.
Elliot had his hand up first, so.
The first question is, you warned the theorists about the photometric uncertainty. So are you talking about 10% in flux? Are you talking
Yeah,
about
so it obviously gets worse further in time. So for this issue about the bolometric luminosity, I don't think there will be a big effect from host galaxy contamination because especially it's less important in the blue bands and it's definitely less important when the kilonova was bright. But at later times, maybe even a week or 10 days, there could be a change in some of these slopes. So I wouldn't worry about discrepancies at that time until we do the proper late time host galaxy removal.
So the other thing is just a small comment because I think there's confusion about this. So the most of the emission at most times from the cocoon model is the same as from the kilonova model. It's radioactively powered emission. So the difference is really just whether there's some shock heating contributing at early times. I think sometimes this is not always appreciated.
Yes. Yeah, I just
This is not exact. First of all, also in the cocoon model, we use two components. And you need low opacity, whatever it is. What we had in the cocoon is two things. Once we have the shock-heated material, which is cooling, in this case, it will be too fast. It will not contribute after half a day. The second thing that we have is that in certain conditions, and it's not necessarily happening in every cocoon, you can bring enough material to velocities that is high enough, so we'll start gaining just from the Lorentz boost. So you get once you get to about beta of 0.5, you start gaining enough. Not too much, but enough to bring you, because if indeed the luminosity was dropping from the first observation, like at least we thought, or we still think, then I find it difficult to explain. It's like a coincidence for the regular kilonova. You just caught it because the kilonova is rising at first for at least half a day. And then you just caught it as it starts going down.
Well, yeah,
And
I don't
in most
think we'll
models,
know.
if you look at the bolometric luminosity, in most kilonova models, the bolometric luminosity is actually rising, also after about 11 hours. So this was one of the advantages that we thought that the cocoon model can help here.
So
it depends on how much material you accelerate to high velocities, and it depends on the opening angle of the jet, of how long the jet is working, what is the distribution of the materials. So you can do different things.
So I just want to add to that that in the model that Juna and I worked on, it's you know, if there's a continuum of shock contributions, you know, and what Mansi and Udi worked on, it was maybe the first half a day, but we were saying in our paper that we think it could be a couple of days where you could have the shock heating actually contributing to the emission. So it's similar but slightly different. And then I just wanted to add a point of support what Mansi was saying. That the other thing you're not showing on here is the photospheric radius evolution. And you can already see that the temperature is doing funny things given your fit at early times, which I wouldn't really expect the temperature to be doing that. And then you'll also find that the photospheric radius is doing funny things if you really assume it's peaking at this time. And I think this is more support that it's actually peaking at 0.5 days or maybe slightly earlier.
I should say this fit is very preliminary and you know, I showed you what the SED actually looks like, and it also, you know, it kind of resembles a black body a bit, maybe in between, but later, as you say, and as we saw from the spectra, it doesn't. look like a black body anymore. So these black body fits are also.
Yeah, but you should plot the photospheric radius you're inferring because it's going to be going in and out if you believe what you've plotted here.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify something on the LIGO side for the timeline. You said we had a delay in SkyMap circulation of 5 hours due to the glitch. We actually had the first SkyMap out on hour and a half kind of timescale where we did deal with the glitch in a preliminary way. What took longer was actually data transfer out of Virgo, and that was the 5 hour SkyMap that was much better localized.
Okay, it's good to know.
Any other questions?
What are the prospects for the future? Let's assume that everything works fine. You get the alert as fast as you can.
Yeah.
How fast will have the first optical detection?
Yeah. So well, I can speak about our survey. I'm sure other people will speak to theirs. So we're using Las Cumbres Observatory for this, a network of telescopes around the world. So as long as it's not behind the sun, we don't really care if it's northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, if it's happened, what time of day it happens. We have it rigged automatically. So next trigger goes in, there's a localization, it's sent to our telescopes, we could be sleeping, and it'll start searching for the counterpart. Also, if it were at 100 megaparsec, if it's this luminous, typically we should still see it. So I think the prospects are very good for the next one, even if it's further away, even if it happens a different time of day, a different part of the sky, as long as it's observable from Earth, we should get it. You know, again, depends if the size of the localization is typical as well. I should say this was in one of the first galaxies that we and the other group searched in. So we should find it quickly and we should be able to follow it up quickly. So I think if you know, there are no glitches and this is a typical event, we should definitely get that early data in the following one. I mean, we still need to find it, but yes.
So, yeah, can I make a comment about it or a question, I guess? So, so you talked about the brightness, so you're talking about the D squared effect, but, you know, when it comes to the localization, the number of galaxies, if that's the approach you're taking, goes like D cubed. And so if you take an event at 100 megaparsecs or 200 megaparsecs, it's now not about searching 30 or 40 or 50 galaxies, it's searching hundreds of galaxies.
Yeah,
so the catalogs are not even complete. So, you know, is that feasibility still?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So as far as we know, that's still feasible. The number of 30 galaxies actually is for 100 megaparsec. In this case, the number was much smaller. So we were able to go down to lower mass galaxies than we planned. So we ended up covering something like 85% of the mass in this error region because it was so close. But yeah, so if it's at 100 megaparsec, it's true that the chances go down because there are more galaxies to search, but it's still on order 30 galaxies is for 100 megaparsec. And the catalogs that are coming out, it's a question of their completeness. You know, they seem, some of the catalogs are complete out to 200 or maybe even 300 megaparsec compared to a Schechter function. Depends a lot on what you assume. But I think as long as we're in the 100 megaparsec scale, this should still work. If it starts going 200 or beyond, we might start having problems. And again, if there will be 40 kilonova a year and we'll get 50% of them, I'm still happy.
Okay, last question from Elliot.
I'm just wondering if you can comment on whether you're doing an analogous optical follow-up of just Fermi triggers? No LIGO triggers?
We are not.
Okay.
But I guess Mansi is. so the error region is much larger, so the numbers I quoted for kilonova completely changed. But yeah, do you want to say something?
We just had first light with the Zwicky transient facility, which has a field of view of 50 square degrees, and we're certainly planning to follow up Fermi triggers.
Mansi, if I remember from Leo Singer's 2015 paper, I think you guys got 8 afterglow, something like that, out of something like, I don't know, 30. Yeah, but they were all long, right? They were all, yeah.
That was with the camera, which with speed factor of 12 smaller. So I think we can do better.
Okay, any last comments or questions? Okay, great. Let's thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
our next speaker is Maria Drought, who'll be talking about the infrared observation, the infrared observations.